Hello, it is episode number 200 of Shop Talk Show. Oh, there is something about those nice round numbers, isn't it? Kind of a big deal. We just did episode 199, obviously, last week. If you haven't heard that, go back and listen. It's Dave and I reminiscing about the history of Shop Talk Show and all the awesome things that have happened with our the guests and just big important things. It was really fun to reminisce on the history, but lots of stuff has happened on PayPal. I remember episode number 100. You know, and because we do this only once a week, that's, I guess, like almost 2 years ago. It doesn't feel that long ago. We had lots of big ideas for that one, just like we had lots of big ideas for this one, and it didn't happen. We just ended up kind of doing a normal show and then doing a more special one at episode number 123, so remember that. That's kind of what's going to happen this time. We have just a more regular show in store for you this time. It's a rapid-fire show. We got questions about us and the show and front end development and design and lots of different interesting subjects that we're going to get into just kind of do it classic style. A classic episode for number 200. We have a sponsor for you, Braintree. The URL there is Braintree Payments. We are literally using Braintree. We have cut a branch for it at CodePen and are actively working on it, using it because it's such a nice API system for accepting payments online. It is PayPal, Bitcoin, Venmo, Apple Pay, Android Pay, credit cards, all of that with a single integration, a single kind of API for working with all of those payment types, which is really cool because you want to offer those payment types for the people that pay for your web app. It's just, and they're nice APIs, too. That's the beauty of it. It's not just an API that can handle this stuff. They're like nice, very well put together APIs. So, it's awesome that they're sponsoring because we're like a fan of them and you should use them to take money on your web app, mobile app, all that kind of thing. It is, they call it their V.0 SDK. So if you're writing in like a Rails app or in a Java app or a Python app or whatever, they have example code that you can use to work on those integrations, which is pretty darn great. They have a sandbox, all that stuff. We'll tell you more about that later in the show. But for now, let's kick things off.
Shopomaniacs, you're listening to episode 200 of the Shop Talk Show.
Gotta be a sound effect for that.
Oh, I don't have the soundboard. I forgot the soundboard on episode 200. Worst.
Yeah, we'll do mouth ones.
Mouth sounds.
We're kind of known for it.
There we go.
You were just kidding almost.
Well, this is what a very, Chris, I got a little bit sentimental and teary this morning because how great is it that we've made it this far, 200 episodes of sitting down talking websites. This is great.
It's great. It is great. It's been a lot of years. We're going on, we could probably have another anniversary when we hit 5 years, whenever the first episode dropped. We were looking at, old designs of the website in the Wayback Machine and stuff. There was one with a big blue header that was so crazy. Like, not really our brand these days.
Off brand.
But yeah,
Reagan Ray set us right.
Yeah. Thanks, Reagan. Yeah. Let's, we're going to do as many questions as we can. Let's have fun with this. Let's do some rapid fire stuff. This is fun too.
I feel like we're getting back to the roots here.
We even had gun sounds back in rapid fire days. Remember that? That was old times. It's become even more. It gets more sensitive of a subject every single day. So I'm glad we dropped it when we did. This is literally the oldest question in my reservoir of Shop Talk Show questions that you all send in. So I was like, maybe we should go grab some like ancient ones just for fun. Like not ones that aren't relevant anymore, but just ones that we haven't gotten around so much in answering. And I thought some of the questions we could get could be about Shop Talk Show itself. So this is literally the bottom most question. So I've seen it a bunch of times and it's never been quite the right show to put it in. Chris Molitor writes in, we really like how you have your site set up so people can listen live live and talk about the podcast. I was hoping you might be able to point me in the right direction for doing something similar, tech, not copy your site, Chris says. So, you're probably not listening live right now, but a lot of times when we have a guest, we promote them and it's able to listen live. It's never been like a totally flawless thing on Chop Talk, as probably many of you know, but it generally works, and I don't think there's been a Dave Rupert blog post that's really explained it. So I wonder if we could just spend like 2 minutes to like tell people what the tech involved with that was, because we've never shared it, I don't think.
Let me just mouth blog it for you. It took a lot of trial and error and kind of figuring out, but let's start. So we're talking over Skype, Chris and I, and then I have a soundboard and I used to do it digitally, but then like Yosemite updated and it broke like compatibility. But I run through a mixer, and that's where the soundboard and the mixer and my microphone go through a mixer.
So you can have two inputs is the point.
So I can have two inputs and they're kind of manually mixed down. Ideally, that would be software, but here's the tricky thing. Skype on Mac is only left channel mono. Oopsie doopsie. Why? I don't know why. Anyway, so now, and we use Skype. This is secrets of the trade. You can use Hangouts too, but we had problems with Hangouts. I think its bandwidth negotiation just isn't quite as good as Skype's and how Skype.
True. And it exerts some weird control over the system audio too, that you can't not, there's no setting to have it not do that. That's why
Yep. So Skype has kind of proven a little more reliable. Almost everybody has an old Skype account they could log into, and so it's been pretty easy in that regard. That's like the software side of things, and then we bring in a robot account on this thing I call the Shop Talk intern. And the Shop-O-Matic intern, I think, is its computer name. And on that computer,
it calls into
the show. Yeah, it's just like a special robot, Shop Talk robot. And then there's a piece of software from Rogue Amoeba called Nicecast. And what this does is it broadcasts a shoutcast is what they're called. They're called shoutcast, but it's like back in the old days of Winamp, people used to just send out MP3s over the web, and you can still do that. This one does a shoutcast. So then you need a shoutcast server. Well, that took a little bit of figuring out. You can set it up on your own server, I guess, but that sounded like a nightmare to me. So we use this company called wavestreaming.net, which I think is in the UK because all the prices are in pounds. But Wave Streaming is pretty great. It has a great UI dashboard, and you can basically choose how many live listeners do you have, 100, 500, a million. And we just do the 100 plan because most of our live shows only have about 100-ish listeners, which is actually pretty good. But occasionally we've busted out of that and had to upgrade. So that gives you a URL to an M3U playlist. It's basically like a playlist of MP3s. Okay, are we following?
Yeah.
And then I drop that into an audio element. And it used to be super complicated. Only some browsers supported this brand of audio file. But now most browsers have caught up in the last 4 years and they kind of support. But
You need a URL endpoint to hit that just starts blasting live audio. And the audio element, for the most part these days, can accept that. So if they hit play on that thing, it's just going to be live.
Yep. And it's basically like a chunked MP3 that sends down to the audio element. And it used to be really 1 week Firefox would work and then it doesn't. And then it didn't. And then Safari worked and then Chrome worked. And so it's sort of really difficult. But then I think when Cisco open sourced their lame MP3 codec or whatever, that made it a little more.
So this service that provides the endpoint listens to a Skype stream.
Yeah. The intern computer, this little Mac Mini I have in my house, shoots up like broadcasts the audio from the Skype call. It hijacks the audio and then shoots it out to the cloud. And then once it's in the cloud, this server is maybe like a few bits behind, but it basically says, okay, you're sending me audio. I'm going to send this audio out. And that's when and we send it to a website. You could also open that, like you could web inspect and steal that URL and put it inside.
Yeah. Which iTunes. We recommended occasionally because iTunes worked with that URL better than the web did at some point.
Yep. So it's kind of,
and then we drop that on a page of the Shop Talk Show site and put below that a chat room. And we used to use like Talk.io, and then I think Talk.io is kind of still around, but I just don't know. Like it fell over enough times that we're like, we should try something else. And then I found some pen that used like React and Firebase and stuff, and that's what's sitting there now. But like none of it's like complicated enough, and we aren't knowledgeable. Like we didn't write it, you know. So it's kind of like, ooh, that's been falling over, and so we're still kind of looking for the perfect chat solution. Or maybe we'll, I don't know. I don't know what the future of Shop Talk Show is. Like so, such a small amount of people listen live anyway. Maybe we'll kind of stop doing live. I don't know. I'm not promising anything there, but I'm kind of thinking we'll replace it with the CodePen powered chat room, because that, like, our chat works super well on CodePen, and it probably wouldn't be that hard to do, which would require you having a CodePen account, but that's, you know, that's, they're free. Hey, small price to pay.
If you're listening to this, you better have one. What's interesting, and I don't know that everybody knows this, but this originally started off as a call-in show, and we built out a whole Twilio infrastructure to where you could click a button and call into the show and call live. But we using our brain mind grapes, our brain thinkers, we realized that could get out of hand really fast, and like YouTube commenty really fast. So there's no way to kind of screen the calls without like spending a month of development. And so we kind of backed off from that, but it was kind of a cool, like, I don't know, we could still probably roll it out, but just this idea, like, I don't know, you can click a button in your browser and call into the show, and maybe we'll roll that out in the future. But I don't know. It was sort of a very special thing, but the logistics of it could have been heartbreaking. So.
Yeah, WebRTC gets better and better all the time. So, which is a great technology for powering that kind of live audio kind of thing. And Twilio is supporting it now too, which is pretty cool. Not a sponsor. They could be though. All right. So that's a little insight into the process of the technologies that work. And, you know, it's just one way, you know, and it's like, I'm sure there's people do a test out there that it's probably not even the best way in this case, but it's worked for us for years and years and years. So enjoy. B. Hindwhistle writes in, how has podcast fame, Dave, changed your life? Is it difficult to do things like shop for groceries with throngs of ravenous teenagers tearing at your clothes?
Hey, listen. I put on my suit made of gold just like everybody else, one leg at a time, you know?
Do you go out in Austin sometimes and literally are at the grocery store and be like, hey, are you Dave?
No. I think what's interesting. We have quite a few, like tens of thousands of people listen to this show, but what's shocking is somebody is like, hey, I know your voice. And you're like, why, how? it's this interesting thing where somebody's, you know, maybe listened to me in the car on the way to a meetup or something, or listen to the show. And so they have they're very knowledgeable about what my voice sounds like. And then all of a sudden they hear it and they're like, hey, I know your voice. That's like their first reaction.
That's how I recognized Garrison Keillor at the airport. A guy walked by that sounded exactly like Garrison Keillor. And I was like, oh man. And I followed him, which is creepy. And I shouldn't have done that, but it really was Garrison Keillor. It's awesome.
Well, I mean, it's, I think that's kind of, that's maybe, if fame is such a weird word, but I think it's that feeling that somebody like knows your voice and knows stuff about you, probably knows I have kids.
It's the audio version of I recognize your Twitter avatar.
There you go. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's happened to me two times ever in my life, and they were both super weird. It wasn't like, oh, we're at a cafe in Palo Alto or like something normal like that. It was years ago, I was in New Zealand for Webstock, and somebody like ran across the street and was like, hey, are you Chris? I was like, oh, hey, awesome. Nice to meet you. You must be here for Webstock. And they're like, what's Webstock? And I was like, okay, that's super weird. So, okay. They were just there to like mountain bike or something. And then one was like another couple of years ago at a mini mall at an art opening for a friend of mine, like quite a bit outside of Atlanta, Georgia. And I was like, both of these were like the most unlikely places ever to like meet somebody that knows who you are. Anyway, I'm going on for three this year. Let's go for a three. All right. Should we do some more of these things?
Yeah, let's keep rapid firing. Let's see. Here's a here's a very early question, I think, from Steve Barcat. Writes in, can you use two different font libraries at once?
Short and sweet, just like we like them. Don't you think he's probably saying, can you use like both Cloud Typography and Typekit? Or because of course you can use two fonts at once, but and then font library is a weird, maybe it means font foundry or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you totally can. You can. I probably have used Google Fonts and Typekit together. But what's interesting, we're in 2016, Chris. Performance is a BFD, a big deal. where are you on the web font, two web font or not two web font?
I would do it with, I think on CodePen we're doing it, we're using a Google font and a self-hosted font. So that's similar. I would be hesitant to use two major cloud providers because for one thing, there's no way to concatenate those resources together, right? So you're talking about individual web requests for all of it, which is not totally rare with web fonts anyway, but it's like, eh. And then being dependent on two third parties at once just seems like extra sketchy to me. I've heard people have the exact opposite advice though and be like, absolutely, you can use as many of these third-party solutions as you want kind of thing. Because technically, there is no limitation. It's only, you know, the BFD, the performance issue. Yeah. It would be your only limitation. If you don't care or have room in the budget or have some other reason why you think it's okay, there is no technical limitation of why you can't use multiple fonts for multiple services. So it's just the performance thing. And taste.
There's an article that has been creeping up on me over at Medium, the Medium design team, designing Medium, I think is the designing-medium is the subdomain, whatever. You guys get it, you're web people. But it's called System Shock is the name of the article. And they, search for performance, Medium has switched to system fonts. And they basically have this is a pretty great story. They're outlining how they got to to all the system fonts with fallbacks and everything for kind of all the browsers ever. And they dropped in the word system, thinking like, oh, they need it, you know, like it's a vendor prefix thing, so they'll put in system. And it like flashed back to a 25-year-old font, like a very 8-bit font from Windows.
Oh yeah, I remember that article.
Pretty kind of funny mess up because like Windows people were getting this really old font again, which is why we shouldn't design
mobile or what? Because like I'm on Medium right now and they're totally loading different custom fonts. They're base 64, but they're custom fonts.
Yeah, I think it was just for mobile, like for mobile performance and everything. So I've been actually kind of looking at this font stack, which is like Apple System, San Francisco Text Regular, San Francisco, Roboto, Sago UI, Helvetica Neue, Lucida Grand, Sans Serif. I've been looking at this font stack and I'm kind of into it. I don't know. I just, until I need a font, I'm starting this thing, like until I need a font, I'm just going to use this kind of basic system font stack until like the need for a strong typographical presence presents itself. But I'm very interested in system fonts for mobile only. I don't know. Just because those devices ship with a pretty great font stack, you know? And then how important is it to be on brand, you know, if like text doesn't show up for 3 seconds? That's sort of, I don't know. That's a tough question for me still.
Right. I think we answered it. There's no technical limitations. There's, you know, if you're doing it, you better have a good reason. Like they have to look excellent together. And this is the only way you can possibly do it and make sure that the performance is still acceptable, which is going to be a tough hurdle to cross. Good luck, Steve. TJ Fogarty writes in, I finished college this year, and I've somehow managed to get my first full-time position as a web developer. I think this is fairly old. Remember, we were like digging deep, because I think TJ has come mm-hmm. along since then. But let's imagine back then, being so green.
Baby TJ.
I've still got so much to learn. One question I've been wondering lately is, when using a grid system, is it better to separate the layout classes from the element you wish to style or combine them to save on markup? I think he sent us a gist, but I think we can imagine, right? Let's say you, let's do the just main content sidebar kind of thing, which is a grid, right? Because it's, you know, something's on the left, something's on the right kind of situation. And you, let's say you use the main element, main class equals content, and aside class equals sidebar or something, because you just, well, you want those classes for whatever reason in your CSS to style some things, and you want to use a class and not the element, let's say, because that's what you're, the naming convention you're going with. Would you use the class name content and sidebar to apply the grid layout stuff to it, or would you add additional classes to those elements that would be the things like grid 3-4, grid 1-4 or something like that? When you work with grids, Dave, do you tend to have grid specific classes?
I do grid specific classes. I am a fan. I know people hate them. I know it's hot drama that you would ever write the word grid in a semantic document. I do declare, but the computer doesn't care, and whatever your team can grok and understand, that's what I'm all about. Mm-hmm. I think having it in the HTML, it makes it actually very great, because, you know, like, you don't have to author SAS and set up a precompiler and run gulp and npm everything just to lay out a page. That's sort of where I'm at in 2016 here. Like, having classes for grid might actually make more sense, because it's like you can just make an HTML page without having.
The argument against it was that, okay, grid 3-4, great. It's like that at one particular breakpoint, but that class name doesn't make much sense at other breakpoints potentially. And usually those are desktop first kind of classes. And then the alternative was to, oh, well, with SAS, I think this is what you're alerting to, you could extend the semantic class, even though, you know, whatever, there's no such thing as a semantic class name, but whatever, you know what I mean? Like, you could extend the content class with the grid class, so like the, you know, content inherits everything that grid 3-4 already has. So like, there's ways to like bend yourself backwards to get this to work, but you're saying you prefer, and I think the where the world is at is generally preferring named grid classes rather than trying to not use them at all.
Yeah. And I think it's like whatever gets your team there, right? Like, if somebody's really opinionated and they're hanging the jury on that, then I don't know. Maybe figure something out. But I've had big conversations about implicit versus explicit grids. That's sort of what I've been calling them. Implicit means it's like kind of the ghost classes, and I don't know, but it's your choice. I wonder if we're ready for grid revolution. I'm going to throw that out. 2016 grid revolution, 2016 grid revolution. Just cause there's so much we can do now with the grid spec that's might mature this year, and B, like the Flexbox is so good. I mean, are we?
That's a big deal. I hardly even think about grids anymore because they're so easy.
No, put in a Flexbox until it messes up, and then you just like chuck some Flex shrink and Flex grow numbers at it. You're just like Flex 8. I don't know. Sure. Okay. Great. It's 8.
Well, it works.
So
great.
8 fixed it. So I think that's kind of where we're headed. I mean, sort of. I don't know. That's actually kind of my preferred way now.
I even have a class because I use third grids so much around CodePen that you just say flex grid thirds, and it just does. That's it. And it automatically, the whatever three children of it are set up into a grid of three with columns between them, and they break at the right breakpoints and do all the stuff. That's just like, it's one class, and it doesn't even care what the three children are. It just does its thing. It's cool.
Just finds a child. It says, child, you flex. Child. Flex, beautifully. Great. So hopefully, TJ, you've come. Your baby TJ is all grown up, and thanks for writing. And Chris, this question comes in. It's for you from Andrew Minion.
Well, that's interesting because I think I just tweeted for this episode, like, hey, send us in some questions. By the way, if you ever want to tweet a question to Shop Talk Show, I have no particular problem with that. Like, our Twitter game is weak, as Dave has said, on Twitter for the Shop Talk Show handle.
We get tens of mentions a month, so it's we're pretty crushing it.
Point is, they're not going to get lost. We'll find them. We'll chuck them in the question. So if that's just if that would be easier for you to sending in a question rather than using our form, that's fine. So this one comes in from Andrew Minion, who writes in, what mouse do you use? And he's just asking the show, I think. What mouse do you use, Dave? Do you have opinions about it, or do you just use whatever's around?
I just grab whatever shraps of metal are on my desk. I really like trackpads. I like the Mac trackpad was
really kind of I bought one and I couldn't do it. I'm fine on the laptop, but I can't at a desk. I can't buy the third party one, or not third party, the one that just sits separately from everything else.
Well, I love it. I think it's great for developers, especially for RSI, repetitive stress injury sort of situations, because it's just a big dumb thing that
I got to force myself
swipe.
To do it. But then you get the motions, right? You get the, because I use quite a few of them now, you know, like the one for spaces and the one for switching apps and the pinch and the zoom.
Yeah, you can do all those. But I think its weak point is Photoshop. Like, you can't do like pixel manipulation, and that's, you know, just like on your laptop, you can't do it. Since I don't use my Mac anymore, I don't know if there's actually a really good Windows trackpad. I should look into that. But I'm using this Microsoft Designer Bluetooth keyboard and mouse, and it's just a really low
Microsoft
profile mouse.
Microsoft has always done really good like peripherals, it. I think.
And I still have the Super keyboard, the Ergo keyboard, and it comes with an Ergo mouse, but the Ergo mouse I could not do. That was a little too extreme for my hands. So I just have a little low profile mouse. It has a mouse wheel. I use a wheel.
I like the wheel.
I use your Parallax websites and I judge you just quite seriously because it's an awful experience on a mouse wheel. So anyway, cool. I'm judging you.
So just a normal, you know, sometimes a regular mouse and sometimes the trackpad. And you can use them both at once, right? Sometimes.
Yep, totally. Yeah. And then I got the new Surface Pro 4 type cover with the biometric fingerprint, which is cool. But the Surface trackpad has also gotten better. So I think Microsoft's like, oh yeah, let's invest in trackpad technology. So that's good.
Lovely. For a lot of years, I used a trackball, a big trackball, like a, you know, it looks like an arcade level size ball kind of thing. And I liked it because it was so great because you never have to pick those things up, you know, like a regular mouse, I feel like it's pretty useful. But once in a while, you got to kind of like pick it up and reposition it and stuff. And that used to annoy
like
me.
You're fighting it around your desk. You're like, dun, 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 dun.
That mattered though when I was cutting clipping paths, which is like a thing I did for like years. Was like my job was to like open a photo and like make a vector path around a couch and a lamp and a tree and stuff. It was weird. It was a weird time, but like it was definitely the mouse to have for that. And I got so used to it that I just kept it forever. I would even put it in my luggage to bring it because I couldn't deal with using regular mouses. And eventually, like, you know, I was like, I got to get off of this thing because like it's starting to get more expensive and more. And eventually they're just not going to sell it anymore. And it's like, ugh. So I just bought a regular mouse and forced myself to use it. So now I'm like, I can just use any garbage mouse. I have like a $20 Logitech mouse and it's fine. It's funny how specific people are about it though. As I was trying to Google it, I Google Logitech mouse, you know, and they make like 10 million different kinds of them. And the first one that came up for me is like some old discontinued one. There's one left on stock on Amazon and it's $170. Because there must be like demand for like, oh, they stopped making the L19B and the L19C is just will never be as good as the B, you know, garbage like that. That's okay. You can have those opinions. I'll reserve the right to laugh at them.
Wow. Yeah. No. It's It's very interesting. I have a friend, Paul Russo, who uses a he has a gaming mouse, I think is what he uses to design with.
With the high performance lasers on the bottom and stuff?
Yeah, and the like 60 buttons on the top and stuff, and like thumb buttons that like a full QWERTY keyboard on the side.
The BlackBerry of mouses.
yeah, the like Logitech BlackBerry.
We could do a whole show on peripherals at some point. People certainly.
I should get care. A. I'm going to buy a gaming mouse and just to see what's the deal. Just to see what I can do. See how I can mess it up. All right. Mark Fisher Jr. writes in, alas, it is still a mystery why Chris ends each show with shoptalkshow.com in a monotone and when that started. Chris, do you know?
I'd like to come up with some elaborate lie or something to be more interesting. I literally have no idea why I do it, why we do it.
I think we used to have a disclaimer about like, you know, this is Shop Talk Show, so restrictions may apply. See server details. And then you just complimented that brilliantly with a.
If there's something like in the show note, we have like a generic format for the show notes that has like what we're supposed to do when. And I think at the end it was like, okay, Dave needs to like ask the sponsor about how to give him money and stuff, and then remember to rate us up in iTunes. That feels weird to say in the middle of a show. And then it was like, oh, mention the website too. like they don't know that we have a website. So shoutdogshowdog.
Yeah.
It's like a little annoying to say it over and over, so I just would say it fast. I don't know. I don't remember what the origin of it. Now it's a thing. It should probably be a t-shirt.
You ever watch those like Joss Whedon shows where it's like grrr, arg at the end?
Yeah, I have. Yes.
It's like that. It's our tag. It's a tag. We call it a tag in the biz, in the radio biz. Yeah. We do.
Mm-hmm. It's a tag.
Yep.
Awesome. Let's see. What do we got? Nick Herr writes in. Nick is here in New York. I happen to be sitting in New York right at the moment. I think I'm going to see him at Brooklyn JS tonight as we record this. Maybe. Hope to see you, Nick. The tech industry can get so caught up in tooling, frameworks, and opinions. We tend to forget about people who put the time and effort into building stuff they care about. One of my favorite parts about Shop Talk, thanks, Nick, is the focus on people, their passions, and some of the stuff they work on. Even Dave Goes Windows has been more about relating to Windows users who write into the show, and so not just like testing out stuff Microsoft has been working on. It's about the people. I think that's true. I never really thought of it that way, but it's not like you switched to Windows so we could tell you about like Windows VR or anything. It was just like more like so we could have a little perspective on what it's like for you to. Anyway, besides being a world famous podcast, what are some of the ways we can support, apply, and encourage empathy in our relatively young community? What are the biggest issues we can focus on fixing as a community? It sounds like you have some opinions about that yourself, Nick, in a sense, and that we should, in your own words, encourage empathy and stuff. I think those are important things. Dave, what can we do? What are the biggest issues we can focus on fixing as a community? How can we apply and encourage empathy in our young community?
This is a tough question. I think the tooling, frameworks, and opinions thing was very astute. Una Kravitz had a really good post about, she tweeted a thing. She kind of agreed with some points, but then somebody was like, hey, did you like read this? And she was like, yeah, I thought so. And they're like, but what about this one where the guy just like insults the grandmother of the person who made React? And she was like, yeah, that's dickish. That sucks. Mm-hmm. And so she, just wrote a really great post about how like it's okay if you don't like something, just don't attack people who made something. Like, no one intends to make bad software, I think is what she said in her post. You know, no one's like, gosh, I'm going to make something that's terrible and release it to the world and spend hours of my weekends working on this thing that's terrible. You know, no one does that. And so I think the biggest issue is not to like tone police people, because, you know, you can be mad about stuff, but like, how you talk about things is very important. Like if your instinct is to kind of bitch about it on Twitter, then like man, I'm losing time and patience for you. Mm-hmm. You know, that's sort of where I'm at.
So. Let me, I have a mouth blog post draft mouth that I can blog. Do right now that's very related to what you just said. And I call it the dig in. And I think it might be a big topic that I'm going to continue to think about. And the idea is that you had some minor opinion or some minor I think people try on opinions too. So a little bit like they're trying on a sweater. They're just like, I'm going to say this today. Just see how it fits, you know. But then you say it and maybe you like it a little bit. Or maybe you don't even like it, but you already said it, so whatever. And then let's say somebody like calls you out on that thing. I think the tendency is to dig in. The tendency is to be like, well, I said it, so now I'm going to really get. Or especially if somebody doesn't just like critique it a little bit, but they might even like get mad in return. Like, you know, you were like, you wrote something and you were a little dickish in it. And when you were writing it, maybe you didn't even think of it that way. But now somebody's calling you out on it. So now you're like, well, I'm going to defend every scrap of every word written in this blog post because I freaking wrote it. So that's the way, you know, that's the dig in. The dig in isn't like, I'm being called out on this. It's highly uncomfortable. But instead of like just breathing it out, you know, or like taking a minute to like see their perspective or have empathy, as Nick would say, you do the opposite. You're like, well, I'm going to write another blog post and I'm going to put their tweet in it. And then I'm going to say how they're wrong and that I stand by everything that I said before and not reevaluate. You know what I mean by dig in?
Yeah. Yeah. Like it's. Yeah, it's like you posture yourself in like if somebody challenges your kind of thoughts, you militarize your opinion,
which I'm sure is not a new thought. I'm sure there's like people have been talking about this for a long time. It's not like I invented the dig in or whatever, but I see it more and more.
Yeah, no, it's just like no, JavaScript dApps are the dumb. You know, it's just like no, like stop. Like. There's a really great post. Mo Lilly on Twitter, I believe, wrote a really great post about like JavaScript apps and progressive enhancement. And just like, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. JavaScript apps are amazing, like when they work and they can serve lots of people. And they do have problems with the brittleness of JavaScript. So let's work, let's encourage, not crucify or you know, criticize people for not being the best on launch day. Let's just encourage server-side rendering for more network tolerance and things of that nature.
That's nice. So maybe that's what, because the question kind of ends up is like, what can we do? And I think maybe the thing that we can do is encourage and applaud and share things that get written and shared and talked about that are even-handed and feel fair and have empathy or whatever. They're the kind of article that says, look, I'm looking at what appears to be both sides of this issue and I'm going to write one right down the middle kind of that takes the best parts of both sides. Like when we see that, we should be like, look at this, you know, not pick like, because you can write one that's almost too far that, you know, there's the dick articles that, which are clearly bad, you know, like don't promote those, you know, that like, this is the way it is, meh. But you can write one that's like the exact opposite of that. That's like, look at this guy. He's like, meh, but everything should be happy. Like that's almost too far the other way. Now you're just fighting, not being the middle. Where the actual like anti-hero here is the middle ground article.
Yeah. So the one I was talking about was by Matthias Schaefer, and it's molily.de, like Deutschland, I believe, /JavaScript-web-apps. And the title of the post is JavaScript Web Apps Considered Valuable. It's worth your read. It kind of marries progressive enhancement and single page applications together in a really nice way. So I applaud that use of reasoning. So Marcus Twister writes in, what do you guys think about the super duper new awesome thing called Post CSS?
I want to know if Dave Rupert has used it in a in a anything, in a even a demo or production or whatever.
I mean, I use Auto Prefixer, which is part of the
other than Auto
CSS family.
Yeah, which everybody uses that, or I would encourage you to because it's awesome.
I don't use Post CSS. I'm still using SAS, I think, day to day, but I'm actually kind of into the maybe going to just straight CSS. I know that, what a waste of time in
classic
life,
style.
But
you still going to have partials? How are you going to do partials? You're just not going to do it. Just go monolith.
Maybe monolith. I don't know. I'm trying to write less CSS, right? Like drastically reduce. And most of it's coming from this thing. The rent is too damn high. Yeah. If you're familiar with that, church of thought. Just to make a web page just takes all this effort, and CodePen actually makes it way easier. I mean, just because I don't have to turn on a preprocessor, it just is preprocessing as I go into it. So that's great. But for me, I'm just like, can I maybe strip this away? And again, only use it when I kind of need it, grow into it. No, don't just start there by default, but grow into things. Post CSS, very cool. I think compiling in Node is great. Without the use of libsass, I'm already using Auto Prefixer, so why not just use Post CSS? I think that's great. Where I think I get weary is, it's kind of this we are future CSS, and that just like Babel is future JavaScript, right? But partials is not a part of future CSS yet. Nesting is not a part of future CSS yet. So I'm sort of mixed up, it's kind of this future spec but not a spec thing.
Clear up the confusion there a little bit, is Post CSS, remember, doesn't actually do anything. It's the plugins that do things. So if you're using one that is supposing to support future CSS, then that's a plugin for Post CSS that's promising that. For example, CSS Next is a plugin for Post CSS that does that. But you don't have that, doesn't, just because you're using Post CSS doesn't mean you're buying into the concept of supporting future CSS or anything else specifically. Just to be clear,
Yeah, no, but it's sort of I have to install Post CSS dash partials or something,
right?
And that's okay, but I guess I'm kind of SAS is working for me, so
SAS is just a language. I think that's, I like that too, that it's we really worked hard and thought really hard about the language of SAS and not stepping on toes and supporting things in just the right ways and not being getting too crazy about stuff. And so Post CSS isn't a language. It's just a way to make an abstract syntax tree from CSS and then a format for writing a plugin to process that. So you want to be I want to write a Post CSS plugin that takes this property and rewrites it into these other properties. Like Auto Prefixer does. It looks for stuff and it's like, oh, I see, I'm going to apply some logic to this. Make sure you got the right prefixes in there and then spit out the right stuff. But you could make one that you could, make a Post CSS plugin that looks for border radius and removes it or turns it into margin or something totally absurd that would ruin the CSS. You can write whatever you want in Post CSS. People don't generally make things that do bad things in Post CSS like that, but they do things that just are up to them. They'll say, well, I'm going to overwrite a existing CSS property and put something there instead, to support future CSS. Or, so you just write CSS how it should be in the future, and then it'll process it down if it can, if it's a feature that can be polyfilled in some way.
Oh, so Chris, boil it down, thumbs up or thumbs down?
I can't do it. I'm going to say thumbs sideways. Thumbs, it feels like the way that it's being used right now, if you go all in on Post CSS and you have this boutique collection of Post CSS modules or whatever they're called, add-ons that's going with it, and that's all you use. You just use Post CSS and you're using 12 different little Post CSS things. There's no there's no way to communicate that to people. There's no shared environment you're speaking in. The language that you're writing in now, because you're using 12 different boutique add-ons, is just, it's your own world now. CSS is your own world, and you're alone there in that world. So unlike SAS, where it's like you're using SAS and everybody's kind of in that world together, that feels a little better to me. Although I do kind of like it, I sort of suspect that the future is kind of like you write in SAS and you do little boutique add-ons past SAS, like things that SAS can't do by itself. You're like you just use like one or two little things. You're like, oh, I really like this one where you can write in the SVG syntax to make a clipping path or something, or you just say polygon and you put some points and it turns it into a base 64 thing. It's like some interesting little bonus point thing that PostCSS can do on top of it. That seems like the way to go. You write in SAS and then you process it with PostCSS to do some extra stuff. And it's dangerous. Like I want to commission an article that's like how to write a responsible PostCSS plugin. Because I think there's really bad ways to do it and decent ways to do it. I think it's going to stick around, but it's still trepidatious territory.
Well, and I think 2016 we're probably, again, 2016 colon getting variables. We are getting probably CSS variables across all browsers. So maybe this is, it's the next frontier, and maybe it'll be way more useful when something like that kind of comes to life.
Could be. There have been some good articles that say that it's almost unfortunately named. They should almost call them CSS custom properties or whatever, because the way that you use CSS preprocessor variables and the way that you use native browser variables are very different. They can both coexist, mm-hmm. and like see it, processor ones are more like architectural decisions, and the native variables are more cascade-y, and use them differently. And it sucks they have the same name, because people think, oh, we got them in the browser now, we don't need these ones in SAS, what are you doing with those? Not the case.
Yeah, well, and again, like cascades and partials all come into play. Like how does a variable extend across 10 different style sheets on HTTP2? Oh, I'm dying in complexity. Can I mouth blog you? Yeah. Draft?
Mouth
blog draft?
Yep.
Mouth draft. I have this working theory that every time you add a grunt task or gulp task or some NPM module, you have created a 30-minute meeting times the number of people on your team. So you've cost your company X number of dollars just to add in a grunt task. Get everybody kind of... Per task. So like every time I found this new NPM thing that puts, outputs a smiley face at the bottom of the page. Thanks, WordPress. outputs a smiley face at the bottom of the page. So every time you do that, you're probably, somebody's going to be like, "What? Hey, why do we have this NPM smiley face?" And you're like, "Oh, that has a smiley face at the side of the team. Oh, interesting. Do we need that? Should we talk to a manager? Oh, let's bring in a manager to talk about this." So anyway, I have this working theory that it's every gulp task, every task we add is 30 minutes plus or times the number of people on your team.
I like it. It's a good draft.
Mouth blog.
Where are we? That was a good one.
Ben Byford writes in, UX is used to describe many different activities. What does UX mean to you and your design process? I believe it's simply more design, part of the process of being a good designer, i.e. doing research and designing for the user, etc. How do you define UX, Chris? In your design process,
like I said in 199, it's like have a little empathy for the people that are using your website. That's what it means to me. It means like think about, just separate yourself from a second and go to your website and look at it from the eyes of somebody who's trying to accomplish a goal and see what it's like to get there. That's what it is.
Yeah, what's interesting is UX it can be its own field. To some people, UX is just a wireframer, somebody who makes wireframes out of their intuition and then they validate these user wireframes against they do user research studies and that's like can also, and then they write big reports for the company about why this would be a good direction for this one template to go. And that's okay. And I think that is a part of everything, but I also think like user experience should be kind of everything. Who was it? It was Jeff Veen on the show. Go back to listen to the Jeff Veen episode. I mean, he's just very plain. He just like UX is your company. Like it's everything. It's the customer. It's the everything. Like everything should be like every decision should be from the light of what does this mean for the user?
I think
and just like, having that in mind,
there's almost no argument against that. It would be hard pressed to be like, no, I think we should be a database first web company. Whatever's best for the database is how we should run our website. You know, that's absurd.
I think where it comes into a problem is when like you have users coming to the site, you know, and then like people, brands, we love brands, right? This is maybe the Twitter story, the Twitter story. You have brands on there who say we want more attention, you know, and we're willing to pay you money for it. And this company is like, well, we like money, so money's good. So maybe we can like do these things together. And so you kind of when you're managing brands or trying to appease brands and users, I think now you're doing a servant of two masters sort of situation, and that's where it's hard. I think like, you know, designing for the user is great, but if the users don't pay you money, now you have to incorporate somebody else into the design decision. I think that's sort of difficult. But I would also argue, just keep doing what the users what's good for the user, you know, and like if brands, I don't know, just let them chuck money at you. But I don't know, like just I think keep building that user base. Keep building it. 2016, keep building that user base.
You know what's good, UX, Dave, is offering ways to pay that is whatever the user, however they want to pay you. Like, why make that the roadblock, you know? Why would you be like, we only take this one payment method only?
We only take this one German, weird German credit card.
You know where I'm going with this. Braintree is sponsoring. Developers around the world have embraced the Braintree V.0 SDK as the easiest way to add secure mobile payments to their apps and websites. We've listed them so many times. No matter what payment way, Braintree accepts it. Apple Pay, Android Pay, PayPal, Venmo, credit cards, even Bitcoin. If there's something new that pops up, Braintree will support that too. That's the whole point of Braintree. It's super awesome. Excellent APIs for taking money. It's used by Uber, Airbnb, GitHub. You know it scales. They have a sandbox for checking it out. The URL you want to go to is BraintreePayments.com. And, you know, do you want example code in .NET, Node, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, Ruby? They got it. Elegant code, clear documentation, as few as 10 lines of code. To get accepting payments in your web app. Thank you, Braintree. Just one sponsor this time. You know, hit up shoptalkshow.com/advertising if you want. They usually go pretty fast. So we should say that this one is also sponsored by the Chris and Dave Foundation with apps like CodePen.io, and the Shop Talk Show job board and Go Day Trip and all the things that Chris and Dave build that is what gives us insight to even have the show at all.
Thank you, Chris and Dave. I'm thinking about Braintree. My uncle writes like credit card systems in COBOL. I know it's super cool, but he like writes COBOL, and he like worked for Chase Bank and things like that. What's interesting is in Spain, I didn't know this, but you have credit cards or whatever, and you can like if you're going to buy a pack of gum, you can say like, oh, I'd rather just like pay for this pack of gum over 12 months. And they're like, cool, we'll charge you 3 cents a month or something. And apparently that's how Spain works. Like you can just make payments on anything you want. And I cannot imagine in my life ever implementing that sort of thing myself. So that's anyway, payment processors are lovely. Chris, you want to do a couple more here?
Yeah, I absolutely do, I think. This is an interesting kind of oldish one from Victor Berland, who says, what do you think about making home servers for websites? Should I use a hosting company or should I build my own Linux server, install LAMP on it, and just have my own computer be my web server? I think that Dave Rupert would enjoy this type of home hackery, but maybe not. I don't know.
Can can I give you Dave Rupert through the ages answers? So Dave Rupert in the 90s says, yes, dude, let's do this. Cause I did it. And, yeah, you like throw a computer in your closet and you put a fan in the closet so your closet doesn't melt down. And then, you just started accepting HTTP traffic through it. That's good. But Dave Rupert in the early 2000s would say, heck no, just pay somebody to do it because hosting stinks. And it's really not that expensive. It's like $7 a month, that, you know, price of a latte or something a month, you know, to have like, just a little bit. I think I would never host a client site on my home server. If they're like your kind of little projects, I think that's great. But clients will call you at 2 a.m.
Your whoever you buy bandwidth from to may not like it and might actually have stipulations against doing it in the thing that you signed when you signed up, you know?
Yeah. Like a gaming server, you know, like just why not try it? Or like audio, you know, thing. A shoutcast server you could do, like in your closet. I think that's fun.
It's also interesting to know that it is not magic. You know, when you buy hosting from a company, it's just a computer sitting somewhere. It might look wildly different or whatever, but it's like running some Linux distro and just doing its thing. It's just a computer like yours or mine, only configured differently.
Yeah. So 20 teens, Dave Rupert says, this sounds fun. That would be kind of fun. So I think you got to be, don't jump into it, you know, like totally ignorant, but it sounds like if you know how to build a Linux distro and forward your IP to it, you're probably fine. But I would be careful for what kind of stuff you're hosting. Obviously no sensitive information, stuff like that. So careful out there, but for your projects, do it. That's fun.
Let's end with this last one by Lewis Horwood, who writes in, what are your thoughts on the increase in self-teaching among aspiring devs? Do you think this is a strength, weakness, or a bit of both, and why? I guess that question presupposes that there has been an increase in self-teaching among aspiring devs. Do you sense that? Do you think there's like do you think Lewis is talking about like Treehouse and Iron Yard and that kind of thing? Like you can, there's more resource, lynda.com, there's more, you know, resources.
Yeah, I would think like it's easier to self-teach you, but I think our industry has always been rather self-taught. I mean, I'm completely self-taught in HTML and CSS and JavaScript. So, but there are people who came out from computer science degrees and there are people who came out from full design backgrounds and they come in and they make websites. You know, I think it takes all kinds, really. I think self-teaching is a strength personally. I think if I had an employee who had to go back to school for 6 months every time just to learn something, I would be a bit like, why, you know, what's going on? Is everything okay? But you know, there are things you can learn in an education environment that you can't learn everywhere.
I don't think there's any downsides to self-learning. There's only downsides to only self-learning.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned like hack schools, like or code schools, like Iron Yard or something like that. I mean, that's a great opportunity. I have friends who are doing these kind of code and intensive code schools and getting jobs. Like they were teachers and they like turned out they hate high school kids, so they're like, I'm just gonna go like learn a skill and get a job, and maybe I start real low, but it's great because I think it's great. You know, and maybe that's just dedicate some time to do it. I think, you know, it's sort of a matter of speed. Does that make sense? Like, I don't know. It's tough because if you go to college and learn for 4 years, you don't necessarily know how to make a website. When you come out, you maybe have like some, or you don't know how to make a modern website, you know, I don't know. That's maybe presuming too much on my part, but I guess what I'm saying is I think being self-taught, our industry has a long history of that. And you see that echoed in posts and podcasts about trying to keep up with the industry. There's a great Control Click podcast with Susan J. Robertson on there, that they talk about the struggle to keep up, but our industry has a great self-teaching history. And I think we should embrace that. I hate that kind of like a degree somehow outweighs the ability to self-teach. But I don't know. Chris, you hire people. How do you feel? Yeah. You hire only computer whiz kids, or would, you know,
it's funny to say that I hire people because I kind of have in a very recent past, but I don't have a very long history of hiring. So I really enjoy like reading people like Rands and Repose or whatever that website with Michael Lopp, who talks a lot about managing and hiring and stuff. It has really big, interesting thoughts about it. I don't know that I could weigh in with, you know, big time hiring decision stuff, but I'd like a self-taught person for sure, but you know, what you do says it all kind of thing.
There's also like that flip side, the recruiter, you know, if they're going through a headhunter or something, you know, maybe they don't understand the history of our industry, and maybe they don't understand that a lot of people are self-taught. So they're just like, we need a bachelor's in computer science to do this thing because that, at least I know they know some computers, you know? I guess the flip side is the people who are doing the hiring probably don't know the technology. Does that make sense? They want they're hiring a JavaScript dev and they ask you about Java, you know, that classic kind of faux pas. But
like I said, this episode was sponsored by Braintree. It's also sponsored by the, you know, the CodePen job board, which is the Shop Talk Show job board, which is the CSS Tricks job board. Your job when you post there goes to all of those different places and supports all of those sites. I get such good feedback on, there's just not a ton of jobs there, but the ones that are there tend to be really good, and they get lots of people applying for them, and the companies are happy with it. And I've heard both from companies and from people who've got jobs from it that everybody's happy involved. So I just like that it's doing its job. Its job is a niche job board. It's well suited for. So there's one particular job. There's a website, 20over10.com. That's this really nice, classy website builder tool. But this is, you know, it's not about that so much as the job. They're looking for a front end designer developer for their web app. It's a fairly new site. It's a very, very modern site that you'll be working on. They need somebody with strong web design skills. It's jQuery, HTML, and CSS kind of site. They want you strong in web standards. They want you up to date on the, you know, modern styles, CSS based design. You know, you just the stuff. It sounds like a company that I would enjoy working for. You know, it's not like this old stodgy company. You know, they're like familiarity with Google Apps. You know, it's one of those companies that's like, we need email for our employees. Let's use Google Apps because that will cost us nothing and not spend like $10,000 a head for some obscure old, I don't know. That's a rant, but the job is for a front end designer developer at 20over10. Check out 20over10.com or follow the link specifically that's describing the job on the Shop Talk Show job board.
Well, there you go. Thanks, everybody, for listening to our 200th episode. Here's cheers to 200 more. We'll be very old at that point, Chris. I think getting into our 50s. So thanks, everyone, for listening. We really appreciate it. Thanks to our sponsors throughout the show, longtime sponsors, short-term sponsors. We really appreciate that you keep the show going. Rate us up in iTunes, 5 stars. It's just that easy. That's how people find out about the show. We really thank you for listening, taking time out of your day, your commute. Really thank you. And follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets. It's just that easy. Chris, you got anything else you'd like to share?
ShopTalkShow.com.